I don't think I've started six yet, right? We ended with slide five. Oh, I didn't even do five yet. Okay. Yeah. Four, let's just make sure. We talked about four, definitely. Okay. Well, in five, we have what's known as the summary reaction for this overall process we're looking at, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. A summary reaction is not really indicative of what happens. What I mean is that the complete oxidation of glucose is not just one step, like this summary reaction implies it is. It's many steps, as we'll see the details of in a little bit. But you can summarize a set of pathways by pretending, basically, that it happens in one step, because then you can see what you start with, skip the details about the steps, and see what you end with. It would happen this way if you actually burned glucose, like you did in the calorimetry lab, but cells don't do that all in one shot. Still, though, if you remember when we were talking about those graphs with that graph G versus time, it doesn't matter. Delta G does not at all matter how you get from beginning to end. The value of delta G depends only on the G of the reactants and the G of the products. So it's the same amount of energy that's released if cells do this gradually rather than just putting a flame to glucose. But the details are skipped here. Now, this is another example of a combustion reaction. And in the previous slide, when we looked at the combustion of methane, which is an organic fuel, I told you that if it's an organic fuel, it doesn't have to always be organic fuel, but if it's an organic fuel, carbon-containing fuel, then you have the same products when you react it with oxygen, which is what combustion means. You have the same products as you would with methane or any other organic fuel. So once again, you have carbon dioxide and water coming out as the material outputs, but a release of energy as well because it's an exergonic reaction. As you would expect this to be, because it's exergonic, but it's catabolic, right? Catabolic because we are breaking down the fuel. And it's a redox reaction. So importantly, how cells get energy, useful energy, from their fuels is by oxidizing those fuels. So just like methane in the previous example, that was the fuel, and the fuel got oxidized. It's true for glucose as well. We oxidize fuels, cells, not just humans, all organisms, to get useful energy that's in the form of chemical energy while it's still in the fuel. And we do that by dismantling, at least partially, the fuel. Now, the overall process that we're studying in this chapter is the complete oxidation of glucose, which means it's not just a partial dismantling, it's a complete dismantling. And only if you go through all of the steps to completely dismantle this fuel will you get the maximum amount of usable energy out. Notice that what's left of the fuel when you dismantle this, instead of having one six-carbon fuel that you start with, you have six carbon dioxide molecules, each of which contains one of the six carbons that's originally in the fuel. So it's a completely dismantled fuel at that point. CO2 you should think of, in terms of cells, as completely spent fuel. It's not useful as fuel. No more energy can be extracted from it, and that's why we get rid of it. The CO2 that you exhale used to be, or is what's left over of the food that you ate, because you burned the fuels. And the oxygen, just like in all combustion reactions, is the thing that gets reduced. Fuel gets oxidized, oxygen gets reduced. And it gets reduced by receiving not just electrons, which is what the definition of reduction is, right? It also receives protons. In other words, electrons and protons together are hydrogen atoms. And that's why when oxygen receives those, it gets reduced into water. That's why water is a product. Okay, energy is not a material product, but it's important, of course, because it's the whole reason we're doing this. Now in 6, this is not a complete reaction, or it's not a completely displayed reaction, I should say, because obviously this thing on the left, this reactant, is not a complete molecule, right? It has some bonds hanging off. What this is showing you, though, is that this is just part of the fuel. Remember building glucose with the ball and stick models? You had six carbons. Each one of them had a hydrogen and OH hooked to it. So this is just one of the carbons in the 6-carbon skeleton of glucose, the master fuel. And that's because when we go to the bit of dismantling this carbon skeleton, like I was saying, to get the energy out of it, we do it a bit at a time rather than all in one shot. And that's what this thing represents. One of the carbons, and you notice that you have 2 hydrogens here to work with. So not only do we dismantle the carbon skeleton, so there aren't any carbon-carbon bonds if we do that completely, but we also strip the fuel of hydrogens. We pick off hydrogens, and that's what qualifies it as a redox reaction. All right, now, what about dehydrogenase? What is that? It is an enzyme. You can tell it's an enzyme because it ends in ASE, for one thing. But you should also, even if it didn't end in ASE, you could tell it's an enzyme because it's not on either end of the arrow, right? It's not a reactant or a product. It's a helper. So you always write that above or below the arrow to indicate that it's an enzyme. Well, enzymes can be named for their substrate, like sucrase that we talked about earlier. This one is an example of an enzyme that gets named for what it does. It's called dehydrogenase because the kind of reaction that it catalyzes is dehydrogenation. In other words, removal of hydrogen. That's what dehydrogenation is. And it's the fuel that gets dehydrogenated. We pick the hydrogens off of the fuel to get the energy, the useful energy, out of those fuels. All right. Now, the only thing we haven't talked about yet is this NAD molecule. Now, that's capital N, capital A, capital D. So the NA here is not sodium. This is not a chemical formula. NAD is an acronym. It's short for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Oops, that's an O. And nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is one of several important energy-carrying particles that we need to talk about in this unit. Now, we've already talked about one really important energy-carrying molecule, which is ATP, right? ATP, if you want to think about this whole process in terms of goals, ATP is the goal. The reason that you're burning or oxidizing the fuel is to use the released energy from that oxidation to build as many ATP molecules as possible. Because ATP, once you have your energy stored in the form of ATP, it's very versatile. You can spend that ATP to do all kinds of different endergonic processes. Nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is an example of a coenzyme. Coenzymes are things that move something from place to place in a process. And so since they move things from place to place, I want you to think of these coenzymes, NAD, and later we'll look at a similar one called FAD, I want you to think of them as little taxis by analogy. You know, a real taxi picks passengers up, doesn't keep them forever, takes them somewhere and drops them off. That's exactly how NAD works. The passengers, though, for NAD are electrons and protons from the fuel. All right? And so just like a real taxi, you can think of any given individual taxi as being in one of two states. It's either with passenger, it's full, or it's empty. Since these molecular taxis, NADs, are carrying, if they're carrying passengers, those passengers include electrons, how would you chemically describe the full taxi?
Charged?
Because of the electrons, but how else could you describe it? If it picks up electrons, what's happening to the taxi? Not oxidized. It's picking up electrons. It's receiving electrons. And so it's becoming reduced. Right. Reduced means carrying extra electrons. The empty taxi would be oxidized because when it drops those passengers off, it gets rid of the electrons. Okay? So this is a redox reaction again. This is part of the overall redox, but this is just handling a little bit of the fuel at once. Now, it's very important to understand that the electrons and protons, which come from the fuel, have associated with them energy that used to be in the fuel. So by picking up electrons and protons, these NADs are picking up energy. That's why I called them originally energy, an energy-carrying particle, NAD, this coenzyme. And therefore, we can think of the taxi as either the reduced form or the oxidized form, but the reduced form, which is the one carrying the electrons and protons from the fuel, is the high energy version of the taxi, because the electrons and protons are carrying energy that was in the fuel. The empty taxi is the low energy. That's the oxidized form. Is that all clear? Well, on the left of the arrow, we have NAD in its oxidized, low-energy, empty taxi state. It's, notice, NAD+. So while it's empty, it has a positive charge. Now we have in the fuel, this little bit of the fuel that we're focused on, two hydrogen atoms that we can pick off. So two particles, if you think of them as atoms, but if you think of them as subatomic particles, what do you have if you have two hydrogen atoms? What do you have as subatomic particles? What do you have if you have just one hydrogen atom? A proton and electron. So if you have two hydrogens, you have two protons and two electrons. Okay? Just don't think of them as atoms. Think of them as four individual particles. Okay, now if you take just one of those electrons and add it to the taxi, that's going to change it from NAD plus to just NAD, because the negative electron counteracts that positive charge. Now you still have one more electron and two more protons. So if you take that second electron plus one of the protons together, that's a hydrogen atom, right? And if you add those, that turns it into NADH. But then you still have one proton left over that can't fit in the taxi, really. So it has to just run alongside. It's just part of the hydrogen ion pool inside the cell. But that's why we symbolically write the reduced form, the high energy form of NAD, as NADH and H+. That accounts for all four of the subatomic particles that get picked off of the fuel in the form of two hydrogen atoms. All right, so this is NADH is carrying a lot of energy. A single NADH is carrying much more energy than even an ATP molecule. So it's not the goal. ATP is the goal. But as we'll see, eventually when it drops its passengers off, it's going to deliver enough energy to make multiple ATP molecules. Right now, though, it's carrying the energy that some of the energy that used to be in the fuel. That's how these coenzymes work. Okay, now, in 7, we're looking at the structural formula for NAD. And if you just look at the name of it, you can see that this long name indicates that the thing is a dinucleotide, which means it's two nucleotides big. We've studied nucleotides before, right, in terms of being subunits to build polynucleotides, nucleic acids, RNA and DNA. And at that time, I told you that a nucleotide, even though a nucleotide is a single subunit, it is still made out of three things itself, right? You have to have three things hooked together for it to be a nucleotide. You have to have a pentose sugar, which you have as a green thing here. Just ignore this top part. Look at these three parts. You have a ribose, that's a pentose sugar. Connected to that, you have a nitrogenous base. This one happens to be adenine that we've already studied. And you have to have at least one phosphate. So this whole thing, these three things just by themselves, if they weren't hooked to the rest of it, would simply be adenosine monophosphate. But on the top, you have another nucleotide. You have a ribose again. You have a different, unusual kind of nitrogenous base hooked to it. We studied 5 nitrogenous bases, right? Adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, which are used in DNA. And uracil is used instead of thymine in RNA. Well, those are 5 that you use for building nucleic acids, but that doesn't mean those are the only ones that exist. This is nicotinamide, which is another nitrogenous base. And since it's connected to a ribose and that ribose is connected to a phosphate, these three by themselves would be a nucleotide. But the two of them together are hooked by the phosphates. And that's why it is a nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. All right, that describes the structure pretty well. Well, this is the taxi I was talking about, and it can pick up passengers in the form of electrons and protons. But those electrons and protons don't go just anywhere, just like the passengers go in the back seat. The place on the molecule where the electrons and protons can go are in this nicotinamide nitrogenous base. So this left box in blue is the NAD plus, the empty taxi version, the oxidized form. It's able to pick up hydrogens or electrons and protons from hydrogen. That's what the 2H is. As I said before, though, there's only room for one proton and 2 electrons. The other proton is there. It's just not hooked to the NAD. But that turns this NAD plus into NADH, plus you have the other proton. Now, the blue part isn't shown again on just for simplicity because it doesn't change. The only thing that changes is the nicotinamide part, but that blue part is still there. They just didn't repeat it in this picture. And notice the reversibility of this. Just like taxis, you know, a taxi doesn't ruin a taxi once it has picked up a passenger and dropped it off. It just means it's ready again. When it drops it off, that's like going backwards, going from the reduced form to the oxidized form by dropping off that energy in the form of electrons and protons. It's able to go pick up more electrons and protons from more fuel. So it happens over and over. And the enzyme that speeds this up is called dehydrogenase because the fuel gets dehydrogenated. That's the source of the electrons and protons, the hydrogen that gets picked off of the fuel. In 8, We're looking at the combustion of hydrogen on this left. So this is a combustion reaction because it's a fuel mixing with an oxygen. But this is not an organic fuel, right? This is just pure hydrogen, no carbon in it. So you don't get CO2 as a result. When you burn hydrogen all in one step, it just turns into water. Which is why if you have a hydrogen vehicle, that would be the exhaust, just pure water. Well, that releases a lot of energy. Notice that this is a graph where the y-axis is G. So the difference between this and this is a big delta G. A very big release of energy when you're oxidizing hydrogen. As you can see if you look at the footage of the Hindenburg burning, because they had to use hydrogen, which is buoyant, of course, but the United States was, we had sequestered all the helium, so they couldn't use helium. And helium's safer because it doesn't burn. Hydrogen burns, though, and burns well. Well, just like I was saying earlier today in the summary reaction, the delta G only depends on the beginning and ending, not how you get there. So you can release all of this energy at once, explosive release of heat and light, that would kill the cell. And even if it didn't kill the cell, it wouldn't give the cell a chance to capture that energy. It would be wasteful because you're trying to capture it in the form of ATP. Well, you have the same delta G on the right, but the energy is released a little bit at a time through many steps. And this part right here called the electron transport chain is an important part of cellular respiration that we're going to look at. That's really what is analogous to a multi-step hydroelectric power plant that we saw earlier in a slide from an earlier chapter. That little bit of a release of energy at once is manageable for the cell, so it not only doesn't die, but it gives it a chance to make ATPs along the way, which is the goal. But these hydrogens come from the fuel rather than being hydrogen gas, like on the left. It's still hydrogen from the fuel, so it still has the same delta G. And you still end up with the same product, which is water. Oxygen receives the electrons and protons from the hydrogen in the fuel, and that turns the oxygen you breathe into water that you make. Now to 9. And 9 is a summary slide. A summary of the overall process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. Okay, that's the entire process, so think of that as the big set. And that overall process happens in 2 major parts. And we can see that on this slide a little bit. The first part of the complete oxidation of glucose is glycolysis, which we see in the teal box here. The second part is cellular respiration. This is why I said earlier that cellular respiration is only part of the overall process. Okay? And I mentioned these 2 parts in the order in which they occur. Glycolysis first, and then cellular respiration. In other words, cellular respiration starts where glycolysis leaves off. Not only are they separate processes happening at different times, but also in different places within the cell. Glycolysis happens in the cytosol, the liquid part of the cytoplasm. So that's what the kind of tan background here represents. This is inside the cell, but it's not in a mitochondrion. It's outside of the organelles. That's the cytosol. And cellular respiration, which occurs after glycolysis, occurs in a eukaryote, which is what we're studying, occurs in a mitochondrion. So that's the first subdivision of the overall process. You divide it into 2 major parts: glycolysis, cellular respiration. Glycolysis has actually 10 parts to it, so the detail isn't shown here. But that's why there are multiple arrows here. It's actually more arrows than that, because there's 10 steps just to glycolysis. And we'll look at those in a minute. But they make up part one of the complete oxidation of glucose. Part two, which is cellular respiration, consists of three parts. So we're subdividing part two of the overall process into three parts. And those three parts are, first of all, something that's not labeled here but is just represented by that white arrow. The first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Pyruvate, as we'll talk more about, is the output of glycolysis. That's what I meant earlier when I said that cellular respiration starts where glycolysis ends up. That's part one of cellular respiration. Part two is labeled here, and it goes by any of three names. You can call it the citric acid cycle, as is listed here, and that's what most biologists would call it. There's also an eponymous word named after someone called the Krebs cycle. That means the same exact thing. Or you could call it the tricarboxylic acid cycle, which is what biochemists would call it mostly. And sometimes they will just abbreviate that to the TCA cycle. Tricarboxylic acid is what TCA stands for. Doesn't matter which of those three you use, although Krebs doesn't really tell you anything about it. It's just the name of a man. They all mean the same thing, though. That's part two of cellular respiration. Part three of cellular respiration is also labeled here. That's oxidative phosphorylation. And so that's part three of part two already, right? We've subdivided the entire process into two, which the second of which is cellular respiration. The third part of that is oxidative phosphorylation, and then we're going to break it down into two parts, which are listed here. Chemiosmosis, or I should give them an order in which they happen, electron transport and chemiosmosis. Together, those two processes make up oxidative phosphorylation. Now, we haven't looked at the details yet, but these names will make more sense when we do. I've said that ATP is the goal, and notice that we have ATP being produced three different places in this overall slide, including part one, which is glycolysis. So I said it's 10 steps. We don't see those details here, but what's happening in glycolysis is that a sugar, glucose, gets split. That's exactly what glycolysis means as a word. Glyco means sugar, like in glycosidic linkage. And lysis means splitting. This is part of the dismantling of the fuel that you have to undergo to get maximal energy out of it. You're starting with a hexose, a six-carbon fuel. Glucose is six carbons big as far as its skeleton is concerned, right? Plus it has a bunch of hydrogens stuck to it. Well, in those 10 steps of glycolysis, which can also be called the glycolytic pathway, you start with that six-carbon sugar and break it into two three-carbon sugars, two identical pyruvate molecules. And that dismantles part of the, it's partial dismantling of the fuel, which means glycolysis by itself only goes part of the way toward the goal of getting as much energy out of the fuel as possible. Right? If you still have three carbon pyruvates remaining after glycolysis, and three carbon pyruvates are fuels in their own right. Each pyruvate molecule is still a fuel because it can be further dismantled. So it's still valuable stuff. And if the cell undertakes only glycolysis, it's basically wasting a lot of energy. It's only partially burning its fuel. Well, that's why if a cell is capable, it will not stop at glycolysis. It will deliver that pyruvate into the mitochondrion and let it be completely dismantled. So pyruvate is partially spent fuel, not completely spent. The job of cellular respiration, which has many parts to it, is to complete that dismantling of the fuel, complete the oxidation of the fuel, and get all the energy that's possible into the form of ATP. Well, glycolysis, as part one of the overall process, in the course of breaking the 6-carbon fuel into 2-3-carbon fuels, releases some of the energy. Now, some, of course, is lost as heat. Every step is going to involve some waste heat because you can't do anything about the second law of thermodynamics. But in some of these steps, some of the energy that's released gets captured enough to build ATP using that energy. And so you have inputs and outputs into this overall process called glycolysis. It's a pathway itself, 10 steps. But the material inputs are glucose, which is the fuel, ADP, which is like a low balance debit card, right? You want to deposit more into that. And NAD plus, the oxidized low energy empty taxi form of this coenzyme. Those come into the process. The outputs are 2 pyruvates, which is still valuable stuff. ATP, because you've used some of the energy that's released from glycolysis to build the ATP out by phosphorylating ADP back into ATP. And NADH, so you've picked up some hydrogens from the fuel in this process. And so these taxis are now carrying that energy in the form of electrons and protons. NADH is the reduced form. Those are the outputs, plus some wasted heat. Now the ATP that's produced in glycolysis doesn't need to be modified anymore, even though this is still early in the overall process. As soon as you make some ATP, that's part of the goal. All ATPs are the same, no matter how they're produced or when they're produced. So this is just part of the goal. But you're not even close to getting all the usable energy into the form of ATP yet, because you still have fuel left, pyruvate, and you still have energy being carried by these taxis that haven't been delivered into the form of putting them into ATP form yet. That's what cellular respiration is all about, completing the process. So the pyruvate comes in and more ATP is produced, but in 2 different ways in cellular respiration. The glycolysis ATP, the ATP that's produced by glycolysis and the ATP that's produced by the citric acid cycle are produced in the same way, even though it's in different places. That way that's produced is called substrate-level phosphorylation, which I'll give you a picture of in a minute. This next slide, I think. The final part, part 3 of cellular respiration, produces most of the ATP. And that's why the balloon here is bigger around the ATP down here. Each individual ATP is identical. What the big balloon means is that more of it is produced here than elsewhere. But also the method of producing this ATP is different. This is not substrate-level phosphorylation, it's oxidative phosphorylation, which I won't explain until we get a picture to show you. Okay? Once they're made, though, they're all identical. And that's the goal, the combined amount of ATP. If you go through all of the steps so that the only thing you have left over from the fuel is carbon dioxide, then you've gotten as much useful energy as you possibly can, and you've maximized the number of ATPs, therefore. Now, the NADHs the full taxis that are carrying the electrons and protons that were originally in glucose, just like real taxis, they are going to deliver their passengers somewhere, right? There's a destination. Well, the destination is the electron transport chains. Notice that the NADH that picked up electrons in glycolysis are driving to the same destination as NADH and FADH2 that are produced in the citric acid cycle. All three of those are carrying electrons and protons, but they drop them off at what we call electron transport chains that we'll study in a moment. That's the big payoff. They're carrying a hell of a lot of energy, because I said each individual one is carrying enough energy to make multiple ATPs. So when they drop off all this energy in the last part of cellular respiration, you have a big payoff in terms of a lot of ATP produced in that final step. All right, let's look at the particulars. Let's start with slide 10, which shows you a schematic representation of substrate level phosphorylation. So this is how ATP gets produced in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle, but it's different when we get to the other method. We'll look at that later. This is substrate level phosphorylation, and the name should tell you that a substrate is involved, right? And therefore an enzyme must be involved, because a substrate is simply a reactant that binds temporarily to the enzyme. Well, it's a pretty simple process. What you have is a phosphorylated substrate. In other words, the substrate is at the moment carrying a phosphate. And when it binds to an enzyme along with ADP, which you want to make the deposit into, it's simply a transfer of phosphate from the substrate to the ADP to turn the ADP into ATP. And the substrate gets dephosphorylated in the process. So the product is the dephosphorylated substrate. Okay, so it's just a transfer of phosphate from a substrate to ADP. That's like making a deposit in the debit card account. Now we can look at a summary of glycolysis. Slide 11 shows you not all the details yet. Like I said, there are 10 steps, but even though there are 10 overall steps, you can think of glycolysis as occurring in two major phases, which are the so-called energy investment phase first, followed by the energy payoff phase. I keep saying that the goal of the whole process is to produce ATP. But what we see here is that in the energy investment phase, the cell actually has to spend ATP. You're doing exactly the opposite of what your goal is. You're trying to produce ATP, but you first have to spend some ATP. And that's because you have to prepare these early molecules in the pathway in such a way that they can go through the second half of the pathway. You have to spend energy in order to make even more energy, just like the adage about money, right? It takes money. You have to spend money to make money. You have to invest money in order to hopefully earn even more back. So that's why it's called an energy investment. And there's two ATPs. These are per glucose. These values are per glucose molecule. For each glucose, it requires two ATPs to be spent. And by spent, what we mean when we say that for ATP is that it gets dephosphorylated, and ATP gets converted into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. Well, the energy released from that prepares the molecules so that they can go through the rest of the pathway, which is the energy payoff phase. And the energy payoff is in two ways. It pays off energetically in two ways. One is that per glucose you make 4 ATP in the energy payoff phase. Just keep in mind that you had to spend 2 to get to that point, though. So you really make a net earning of 2 ATPs, which is what the bottom shows you. This is the bottom line. Okay, so it's a net earning of 2 ATP because you spend 2 to earn 4. But you also importantly get, in the energy payoff phase, 2 NADHs, 2 reduced coenzymes, which are carrying even more energy. All right, they're just going to hang around. They're going to deliver it to that later process for the big payoff. And the other material output, of course, is the pyruvate, which is not completely spent fuel. It's only partially spent, so it's still valuable in terms of energy as well, as long as you can keep processing it. Glycolysis is over. There's nothing more that glycolysis can do. But if you're capable, if you're a cell capable of cellular respiration, like a eukaryotic cell with a mitochondrion, then you can take that pyruvate, that partially spent fuel, and undergo cellular respiration, which finishes the job of dismantling the carbon skeleton. That'll be the big payoff. 12 gives you more detail of glycolysis, but this isn't all of glycolysis. This is just the first 5 steps, which collectively make up the energy investment phase. If you look at the left, you start with glucose, and you're going to go through several steps like you would expect in a pathway, right? Each individual reaction forms a product that then serves as the substrate for the next reactant, and so on. And I say substrate because each of these individual steps is catalyzed by its own specific enzyme. Notice these names end in A-S-E. Well, the very first thing you have to do with glucose is spend some energy in the form of ATP to turn glucose into glucose 6-phosphate. Glucose 6-phosphate is just a phosphorylated glucose. It's glucose 6-phosphate because the sixth carbon, remember the carbons are numbered, the sixth carbon is the one that receives the phosphate. In other words, you're activating the sugar. You spend the energy from ATP to activate the sugar to make it a phosphorylated one. That's part of the energy investment. No dismantling of the skeleton has occurred yet. You still have a 6-carbon fuel, but it's a glucose 6-phosphate. Then it just gets turned into a different 6-carbon fuel. Still no breakdown. This is fructose 6-phosphate. It's an isomer of glucose 6-phosphate. They have the same chemical formula, just a rearrangement. But it's still not dismantled at all yet. And then you spend some more energy in the form of ATP to phosphorylate this 6-carbon sugar again. That's why it's now called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Bis and bi mean the same thing. They mean 2. So it's phosphorylated at carbon 1 and carbon 6. That's the preparation that you have to spend energy for, because only in this phosphorylated state can you go on to the rest of the pathway to have the payoff. Well, that brings us to a fork in the road, notice, which is what's enlarged on the right side. This is the same thing as this bottom. You have the doubly phosphorylated fuel. And the reason it's a fork in the road here is because when this thing is reacted, when this next reaction occurs, there's 2 possible products. And the cell doesn't really know which one is going to occur because for energetic reasons, they're about equally likely. The 2 possible products are, as you see, dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. The thing about this is, though, which you can see on the left-hand side, is that only one of these 2 possible products, specifically glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is sometimes called G3P, only that one can go on to the rest of the pathway, to the energy payoff phase. Which would mean if you just randomly, half of the time, make dihydroxyacetone phosphate instead of G3P, you would be wasting about half your fuel, right? Because it couldn't go on. But thankfully, that's not what happens. Because if the cell does make dihydroxyacetone phosphate instead of G3P, it's a simple matter to turn dihydroxyacetone phosphate into G3P. That's what these side arrows are, which is just a rearrangement. It's an isomerization, right? You're turning one isomer into another isomer, and that's why the enzyme responsible for that is called isomerase. So, yes, it is. Both of these things can happen. Only one of them can go on, but even if this one happens, it will be turned into the other. So, effectively, all you have produced is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. and all of that can go on to the energy payoff phase. Notice also that in this fork in the road, you have finally broken the 6-carbon skeleton partially apart. So for each glucose entering this energy investment phase, you form two, which is, you start with that 6-carbon glucose, and you make 2 3-carbon glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates. So that's part of the dismantling, but we haven't seen any ATP get produced yet. That's what the energy payoff phase is for, which is in 13. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate then gets oxidized. I know it gets oxidized because something else here is becoming reduced, right? Oxidation and reduction go hand in hand. So in terms of fuels, the fuel always gets oxidized. Something else gets reduced. Well, the thing that gets reduced is NAD+. NAD+ is the empty taxi. It's picking up the electrons and protons, so it's becoming reduced. The energy is losing those electrons, so it's becoming oxidized. And that NADH that comes out is one part of the payoff. Now, it's listed as 2 here because this happens once for each of the 2 G3Ps. On a per glucose basis, everything on the energy investment phase is doubled because it happens for each of the 2 3-carbon outputs. Okay, so 2 NADHs are produced, and then in a later step, 1 ATP is produced for each of those 2 3-carbon chunks, and therefore an overall 2 per glucose. Then you rearrange things for a few steps, and then at the bottom you have another payoff in the form of ADP getting phosphorylated into ATP. This is substrate level phosphorylation that's taking place there. So that's where the 4 ATP per glucose come out, but you had to spend 2 to get there. That's why it's a net of 2 earning. Now when you get to pyruvate, you still have, as you see here, a 3-carbon sugar, and you still not only have you dismantled it into 1-carbon bits, but you also have some more hydrogens that can be picked off. That's why this is still valuable fuel. That brings us to 14. Now it's time to talk about the particulars of cellular respiration, which is the rest of the overall process. Glycolysis was just the first part. Now we're looking at cellular respiration. And specifically, we're looking at the first part of cellular respiration, which I've told you is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Pyruvate is what glycolysis spits out. Partially spent fuel, still valuable. And glycolysis happens in the cytosol, so that's where pyruvate gets produced. Cellular respiration is occurring in the mitochondrion. So part of this first process, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, involves getting that pyruvate into the mitochondrion. That's represented by the white arrow here. The mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle, remember. Has an outer and an inner membrane. Well, the pyruvate has to travel through both membranes here in orange that you see. It's more than just about importing it into the mitochondrion, though. In the process of getting taken into the mitochondrion, the pyruvate gets chemically altered. That explains the rest of its name of the step. It's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. So oxidative tells you that this step is going to involve a redox, right? Oxidative. And what does decarboxylation mean? Or what would you guess just based on the word? Removal of carbon and oxygen, but specifically removal of those in the form of carboxyls. Decarboxylation means removal of a carboxyl group, which you've already studied the structure of, right? So let's look at pyruvate here on the left side while it's still in the cytosol. This is the output of glycolysis. It's the partially spent fuel. It has 3 carbons, But notice that one of those carbons, along with two oxygens, form a carboxyl group. Now, you learned that carboxyl would be C double bond O and single bond OH, right? That's how you learned it. Which is true, that's a carboxyl. But if you take one proton away from that, which happens easily at the pHs in which cells live, then you have an O negative instead of an OH, right? The electron is still there, but the proton has left and it's in solution. I just wanted to explain that the gray thing is a carboxyl, even though the hydrogen isn't there anymore. Okay, so when this thing comes in, you're removing that carboxyl group. And the carboxyl by itself is just going to come out as carbon dioxide. So this carbon dioxide is one place in the process where CO2 is produced. But each individual CO2 is one of six that will eventually be produced for each glucose. Glucose has six carbons. Completely dismantling it and dehydrogenating it means all you'll have left is CO2 individually. Well, this is one that's coming off from one pyruvate. But remember that there are two pyruvates made for each glucose, right? Because you split the glucose into two. And therefore, this happens for each of those two pyruvates, and the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate forms two CO2s. CO2 is completely spent fuel. So that is useless as far as energy is concerned. But when you strip the carboxyl from pyruvate, that turns it into a two-carbon compound, which is not yet completely dismantled, right? So the rest of it is still a useful fuel. The carbon dioxide is useless, but what's left after you take that away is still fuel. Not only does it get decarboxylated, though, the rest of the phrase tells you that oxidation takes place. Well, what gets oxidized is the fuel, and what gets reduced is NAD plus into NADH. So this is another example of an empty taxi picking up energy in the form of electrons and protons, but this time from the pyruvate fuel. Okay? This is valuable stuff, this NADH. So it's going to drive to the same destination as the NADH that was produced in glycolysis. It's going to drop the passengers off, the electrons and protons, at the same place. But that's later. Okay, now this remaining fuel is just a two-carbon compound. Now ignore this brown part that says S-CoA. If you had just these two magenta-colored Cs and the oxygen and hydrogen associated with it, that is a functional group itself that we didn't bother learning in this one. Remember I said that there's other functional groups besides the ones you had to learn. Well, this functional group would be called the acetyl group. And when it gets produced by being what's left over after you decarboxylate pyruvate, that acetyl group gets picked up by another kind of taxi, another coenzyme, which is specifically called coenzyme A. The S, which is a sulfur atom, is part of coenzyme A. The reason it's individually listed here is because it's that sulfur part of the coenzyme A taxi that is able to pick up this acetyl group. So when that happens, you don't have just acetyl. You have what's called collectively acetyl coenzyme A, or just acetyl CoA for short. That's another example of a coenzyme, which, remember I said, are things that pick up and then drop off. So it's now picked something up. It's picked up what's left of the fuel. And you would have two of these for every one of the glucoses that you start with, right? Because you have two pyruvates, therefore you end up with two acetyl coenzyme A's. That's all the fuel that you have left, because you also produced a couple CO2s, which is completely spent. Any questions on the first part of cellular respiration, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate? All right, let's go to 15. Now, 15 shows you more than just the second part. It shows you actually the first and second part of cellular respiration. This top part is what we just looked at, but in a different picture. This top part is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And for simplicity, only the carbons are shown. Of course, the oxygens and the hydrogens are there as well. But it's the carbon showing you the skeleton. The carbons are showing you what's happening to the skeleton. The pyruvate is a three-carbon fuel. It gets decarboxylated, so that's one of the carbons, leaving a two-carbon fuel in the form of an acetyl group that gets picked up by a taxi called coenzyme A to make the full taxi that's called acetyl coenzyme A. In other words, coenzyme A with an acetyl passenger. Well, it doesn't have to drive very far to get to its destination. Coenzyme A delivers acetyl, which is what's left of the fuel, to the very next part of cellular respiration, part two, which is the citric acid cycle. Okay, so it picks up, coenzyme A picks up acetyl from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, part one, and drops it off to part two, the citric acid cycle. Now, the details of the cycle aren't shown here. We'll look at that in more detail in a bit. But this is kind of a summary of what the important accomplishment of the citric acid cycle is. The citric acid cycle, or tricarboxylic acid cycle, or Krebs cycle, accomplishes the complete oxidation of what's left of the fuel. So by the time you're through the citric acid cycle, all you have left of what was originally glucose is just more CO2. Right? Each acetyl is a two-carbon skeleton. It gets broken apart in the citric acid cycle so that you make two more glucoses for each of the two acetyl. For each of the two acetyls, you make two CO2s because you're breaking a two-carbon into two one-carbons, right? But remember, you had two pyruvates, so you would multiply that by two again per glucose. That would be four CO2s plus the two that you made earlier in the decarboxylation step. That's six carbon dioxides. That's six, when you're at the point of six carbon dioxide, you have completely spent your fuel because you've broken that single six carbon chunk into six one carbon chunks and taken all the hydrogen off of it. That's why it's CO2 is completely spent fuel. Well, we're not done with the process, right? This is only part two of the three-part cellular respiration. But even though we're not done, the fuel is done. So in part two, you've already used all of your fuel. Now, some ATP gets produced in the citric acid cycle, and that occurs by substrate-level phosphorylation, just like it did in glycolysis. That ATP is the goal, so it's ready. No, doesn't need to be processed any further. But also notice that in two steps, two different places in the citric acid cycle, you produce even more full taxis, reduced coenzymes. Three NADHs here, and also an FADH2. This is another coenzyme. It's like a competing company. It's a different fleet of taxis. They do the same job, but they're in different kinds of cars. All right? FAD works very similar to NAD, except the F stands for flavin. So FAD is flavin adenine dinucleotide. It has a different nitrogenous base, flavin instead of nicotinamide. So just like NAD exists in either of two states, oxidized low energy and reduced high energy, same is true for flavin adenine dinucleotide. But notice that the lower energy form is not FAD+. It was NAD+, but the low energy empty taxi for flavin is FAD. Since it's not positive to begin with, it can take both electrons and both protons from those two hydrogens, and that's why the reduced form is FADH2, and you don't have any H+ left over. You understand what I'm saying there? You still have four hydrogens that you're taking off the fuel, but all of it goes into the taxi. You don't have this proton left over that's just in solution. FADH2 also is very valuable stuff. It's carrying more energy than ATP, so it can end up making multiple ATPs with its energy. But for reasons I'll show you later, it's not actually quite as valuable as NADH. NADH is carrying even more when it comes to converting it into ATP form later. All right, so that's what citric acid cycle does. It completes the oxidation of the fuel. Well, we're looking at greater detail in 16. This is the same cycle, but now we can see the steps just to show you that it's truly a pathway. Any pathway is a sequence of reactions, like we've been talking about. But up to now, we've been thinking of pathways as being linear. A cycle is a pathway that just has it, the end of it feeding back to the beginning of it, kind of like a start-finish line on a racetrack. So this step 8, where oxaloacetate is produced, that's the end of one trip through the pathway, but oxaloacetate then can go back to step 1. Only, though, if you add acetyl, which is what coenzyme A, in the form of acetyl coenzyme A, is dropping off. Coenzyme A doesn't enter the citric acid cycle. It just drives up to it and delivers the acetyl, the passenger. Okay, now notice what oxaloacetate at the end is structurally. It has 1, 2, 3, 4 carbons. Okay? Think about what you're trying to accomplish. You're trying to dismantle a carbon skeleton, right? Well, this seems like you're doing the opposite of what you want to here, because this 4-carbon oxaloacetate picks up the 2-carbon acetyl that gets dropped off by coenzyme A to form a 6-carbon citrate. So instead of dismantling it, you're building it up even more, right? But that's just to prepare it, because then you can dismantle it along the way. And in 2 different places does that dismantling occur. Here at step 3, you have a CO2 coming off, because that's one of the carbons that were in it. And then in step 4, you take another CO2 off. All right, so those CO2s that come off really are representing each. One of them represents one of the carbons in the glucose and one of the carbons in the acetyl that came from the glucose. So as long as this thing keeps going around, you not only dismantle what's left of the fuel, but also, importantly, like we talked about before, in 3 different places, you reduce NAD plus into NADH and H plus, valuable stuff. And in one of the steps, you reduce FAD into FADH2, valuable stuff. Plus, in one step down here at the bottom, through substrate-level phosphorylation, you turn an ADP into an ATP. Not only valuable stuff, but the goal, the overall goal. Since we're out of fuel at this point, at the end of the citric acid cycle, no fuel remains. We've made only a little bit of ATP, which is the goal. There can't be any more energy gotten out of the fuel, which means if we're going to make more ATP, that energy has to come from somewhere. Well, where is that energy? It's in the form of the reduced coenzymes that picked up the energy in the form of electrons and protons along the way. You made NADH in glycolysis. You made NADH in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. You made a bunch more NADH in the citric acid cycle. Plus you made FADH2 in the citric acid cycle. Those combined full or reduced coenzymes represent the remaining energy that was in glucose and could still be put to use. Now, some of the energy was lost as heat at each individual step, and that's just part of the inefficiency. You can never get that back. It's just nothing you can do about that. But these storing molecules, these coenzymes, still have energy that you can get a lot of that put to use. They're going to involve some waste as heat as well when they give up their electrons. But it's still usable energy, and that's why even though the fuel is gone, we can still make a bunch more ATP. In fact, many more than we've already made up to this point without any fuel being left. That's what the overall part three of the process is about, part three of cellular respiration, which is shown in slide 17. And this is kind of two in one. It's kind of an anatomical picture, but it's also a graph, notice, because you have on the y-axis G, so the higher up, the greater the value of G. The purple things here are protein complexes. Well, the big purple things are. The ones that are labeled with Roman numerals. 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's IV. Shouldn't have been a space after it. 1, 2, 3, and 4. These are protein complexes that together, there's four of them, but these four protein complexes together in this arrangement make up what is called an electron transport chain. And a lot of textbooks will talk about the electron transport chain, which I don't really like because that kind of sounds like there's one. Well, there are millions and millions of these things, copies of them. This is just one copy. Each individual cell in its mitochondrion, there are multiple mitochondria in each cell, but each mitochondrion has many, many, many copies of this. This is just one of them. All right, so that's why I said an electron transport chain. But an electron transport chain does exactly what its name tells you it does. It transports electrons. And it has to be arranged a special way. So these things are not just floating around in liquid. These protein complexes that make up an electron transport chain are organized and kept that way because they are bound to a membrane. These are membrane-bound protein complexes. And it's not the plasma membrane I'm talking about, because this is part of cellular respiration, right? We're inside a mitochondrion. The membrane that these electron transport chain members are part of is the inner mitochondrial membrane. Remember that the outer mitochondrial membrane is just as big as it needs to be. It's a smooth outer covering. But the inner mitochondrial membrane folds back and forth. So it's actually much bigger than the outer membrane. Remember what the folds are called?
Crenations?
No, that's wrinkling of a cell in a hypertonic environment. But the first two letters are correct. They are called cristae. The folds are called cristae. And we talked about, when we just talked about the anatomy of the mitochondrion, we were talking about the fact that these folds, these cristae, are there to add membrane so that the more membrane you have, the more of these you can have, which are the electron transport chains. All right? That's what makes it such an efficient process, because the more copies of this you have, the more fuel that can be processed in a given amount of time. This is just one, though. So we don't see the membrane here, but these are all part of the phospholipid bilayer that makes up the inner mitochondrial membrane. And the diagonal arrangement is not anatomical. That's part of the graph. Notice that it's going downhill in terms of G here. That's important, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But the electron transport chain that we're looking at is operating more or less like a bucket brigade, which is an admittedly old-fashioned example. But do you know what I mean by a bucket brigade? Well, if you live out in the middle of nowhere on a farm and your barn is burning, but you don't have city water, the neighbors notice that that the barn is on fire. You have one source of water, which is your well, wherever it is. And so neighbors would get together, form a line called a bucket brigade, lined up between the well and the fire. And the person at the well fills it up, hands the bucket to the next person, and so on. The last person dumps it on the fire. It's a lot more efficient than running back and forth. That's what an electron transport chain is like, except instead of buckets of water, what's being passed from member to member are electrons. And that's why it's called an electron transport chain. All right, now where do these electrons come from?
NADH?
Originally, where do they come from? The fuel, exactly. They were electrons originally in glucose. But remember, it's several different places along the way. Some of those electrons got stripped, electrons and protons, got stripped in the form of hydrogen atoms that were in the glucose originally. And they're being passengers in these full taxis. Well, I told you that these taxis are all driving to the same destination, even though they pick up passengers in different places along the way. They drive to the same destination. And that destination is the electron transport chain. That's why you have NADH up here delivering its electrons to the chain, to the first member. All right? So this goes along with what I was saying before. The electrons that are the passengers of these taxis contain energy. So it's not just particles they're transporting, it's energy that they are delivering to the electron transport chain. And that's why this graph is in terms of energy on the y-axis. G is free energy. Now, think about chemically what's happening here. An electron gets delivered from the taxi to the first member of the chain. Therefore, what's happening to the first member of the chain? It's becoming reduced. Exactly. The first member gets reduced, and the taxi gets reoxidized. It's empty now. It can go back to the earlier parts of the process and pick up more electrons from more fuel. Okay. Importantly, it can't do that right now because it already has passengers. But as soon as it gets rid of them, it gets reoxidized into NAD+. It can go back and do its job again. But the first member of the chain gets reduced by receiving that electron. It's not going to hang on to it, just like a person right by the well isn't going to hold on to the bucket. Right? It's immediately going to pass it to the next member. So this stepwise transfer of electrons that occurs along the chain is really just a series of redox reactions. Because each member that passes it to the next is going to become reoxidized and it's going to reduce the next member. Does that all make sense? Because reduction is receiving an electron, oxidation is getting rid of an electron. Now, the reason why the cell bothers to do this, which kind of seems like a complex way of moving electrons around, is that every time an electron gets passed from one member of a chain to the next, the electron ends up getting a little bit closer to an atomic nucleus, meaning the electron goes down in energy, right? The lowest energy level is the one closest to the nucleus. That's why in this figure, as a graph, it's a downhill process. The transfer of electrons means that a little bit of energy gets released in each transfer. This is exactly what was represented by the multi-step hydroelectric power plant. A little bit of the energy, not all of it at once, gets released in the electron transport chain. All right? Now, when the person right by the fire gets the bucket, that person's job is to empty the bucket onto the fire, right? And only if that person does empty the bucket can that last member of the brigade receive a new bucket. You have to empty yourself before you can receive another one. In other words, this last member of the chain has to become reoxidized by losing its electron in order for another electron to be able to reduce it. If you don't have something at the end of the chain taking electrons off of the end, then the chain eventually will just fill up with electrons and everything will stop. You see that? That would be like plugging up the output of the hydroelectric plant. It would stop running. And so there needs to be some sort of particle that's willing to take those electrons off of the end of the chain. And that willing participant is oxygen, which should make sense to you because oxygen has a high electronegativity, right? It will gladly take electrons. And that's what allows the chain to continue to transport electrons. By taking them off the end, it allows more to be put onto the beginning, keeping them trickling down. That's a big overall step, change in G, which is why this is an exergonic process. Now I'm out of time, so I haven't finished this slide yet, but keep thinking about it. We'll finish it up next time. Thank you.